part of the mythology of the Lost Cause, or the neo-Confederate mythology, if you prefer, is that slavery, while not a good thing, was really not all that bad. I mean, after all, there were some good masters, and slaves got 3 square meals a day, and they were cared for, etc., etc. This, of course, is nonsense. Slavery was bad. The slaves didn't like being slaves, and from time to time, they made their discontent manifest in some fairly concrete ways, sometimes even with violence. Today, we're going to hear from law professor Al Brophy, who's going to tell us all about a major slave rebellion. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week, it's all about Nat Turner's rebellion.
Your weekly Constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
Al Brophy is a law professor at the University of North Carolina, where among his many interests and his many works, he concentrates on the Jim Crow South. He concentrates on slavery and its aftermath. And he comes up with some really remarkably interesting things. Some months ago, you may recall, I interviewed Al about something called the Negro Motorist Green Book, which was a guide for black people during the Jim Crow era, helping them get from place to place and find safe place to shelter for the night or places to use the bathroom or all the things that Jim Crow made it so difficult for African Americans to do. That was a great episode, and if you want to listen to it, please check out our podcast site. It's simply called The Green Book. But today we're going to talk about not the Jim Crow South, but slavery itself. And we're going to talk about a very famous, but to some extent lost to history, incident called Nat Turner's Rebellion. Nat Turner was a slave. Nat Turner didn't like being a slave. And Nat Turner was charismatic, he was intelligent, and he was a leader. And he led some of his friends into what would become the most violent, the most notable, and ultimately the most tragic slave rebellion in United States history. Here's Al Brophy.
Nat Turner was a young man in his, we think, low 30s. He's born around 1800, who had grown up in Southampton in this county where a lot of the population were enslaved people. There were some free black people and a few Native Americans.
Was he born into slavery?
He was born into slavery. Okay. We don't know much about his father. His mother, we think, was born in Africa and then came as an enslaved person to Virginia. There's sort of a mystery that's grown up around Turner. He was a self-educated preacher, and a lot of people in the enslaved community looked up to him. And there's some evidence that he baptized some white people as well. So there's a lot of mystery about him. He was a person in some ways set apart from the rest of the community, and somebody who had been planning, we think, for some time, a rebellion. And he initially set it for July 4th, 1831, irony of ironies or something, right? And in some ways, it's a prefaces Frederick Douglass's speech some decades later, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July."
Before we leave his parentage, I know a very important aspect of slavery is the intermingling of European and African blood, because slave owners basically would rape their slaves. Is there any indication that what Nat Turner resulted from such a union?
You know, it's really interesting. One of the many things that is it captures the attention about the Nat Turner Rebellion is how much oral history there's been built up around that, and a lot of there's an oral tradition that he was part white, and there's some suggestion after he was a fugitive, the advertisement that was circulated suggests he was sort of light skinned, and that has been taken by a lot of people to suggest that he had some European as well as African ancestry.
Okay, so he's born however he's conceived. He's born roughly 1800.
And so he's a young man, low 30s, and had been planning, you know, sort of working as an artisan, but also as a preacher. Collected some people around him, and planned this rebellion for 1831. There's an eclipse that seems to have sort of given him the sense now's the time to strike a blow for freedom. And so he collected about half a dozen loyal followers at a mill pond in Sunday evening, I guess it was August 21st, 1831, and they set in motion this rebellion, which involves basically murdering the family that owned him, and then him being Turner, and then sort of marching through the evening and into the early morning hours, and into the morning of that next Monday, killing and then slave owners, and then collecting more slaves, and sort of trying to have the rebellion snowball as it went. One of the things that's really difficult to pin down, and this is what maybe makes the story great for historians to work on, is how much advance planning was there. You know, is this something that people just sort of ran to the rebellion as soon as it was going, or had there been some really extensive planning ahead of time? In the white community afterwards, there's a lot of fear that this was a well-planned rebellion, right? Mm-hmm. They're very afraid that a bunch of people were involved in it, that they'd been thinking about it for a long time. There's some testimony from a young enslaved girl that they'd been planning this for months. They met at a church meeting that spring. And then there's some speculation in the white community that this plan, you know, stretched much further than Nat Turner. Maybe he was just a small piece of a plan that maybe stretched, you know, throughout the Roanoke River Valley down into North Carolina. And so that feeds the white fear that there's an awful lot going on. Who knows? There's not a lot of evidence that it was well planned, or that it had been much pre-planning.
You know, it could have just been Spartacus. It could have just been kind of just got fed up one day and got rid of his own slave-owning family, and then he was figuring or hoping that it would begin to snowball.
There's an awful lot of – that's sort of what it looks like, isn't it, Stuart?
Mm-hmm. That's what it reminds me of anyway.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's – so one of the things that people talk about is, was this, as you suggest, you know, sort of Spartacus, you know, person, man of action, taking – impulsive action, or was this something that, you know, had been pre-planned, that the abolitionists had maybe coordinated? There's in 1829, there's this very famous pamphlet put together by David Walker, who's a free black person who lives in Boston, called The Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World. And a lot of people in the South are very afraid of Walker's pamphlet. There's a lot of talk about how that sort of sets in motion ideas of rebellion. It's very unclear whether Turner ever read this. Of course, the ideas could have traveled even if he hadn't read it.
Do we know whether Turner could read?
Yes, he could. In fact,
here's an important point, though. That was against the law to teach slaves to read in Virginia at that time, wasn't it?
Very much so.
And for this very reason, they were scared to death of abolitionist literature. Or just generally slaves getting ideas.
The concern that Southern whites had with literacy is, I think, some of the best testimony of how much the Enlightenment project of the printing press was a vehicle for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As soon as people got the ideas, they could transmit them very easily through the printing press. You know, this is sort of like, much like Thomas Paine's Common Sense made, you know, was an impetus to the American Revolution. There's a lot of thought that David Walker's Appeal to the Colored Citizens and the Declaration of Independence and all sorts of other things were you know, spurs to rebellion.
Not to get too far afield, but I'd hate to interrupt you because I want to get to the rest of the story about the rebellion, but not only was there a prohibition of teaching African Americans to read, there were also a lot of restrictions on mailing this stuff or distributing this stuff, abolitionist literature, that is, in the South.
It's a great point. So one of the things the abolitionists do, you know, even before Nat Turner, but certainly in the wake of it running into the mid-1830s, is they use the U.S. mails to deliver abolitionist literature. And so Southerners are then in this real sort of dilemma. What are we going to do? They don't want to, you know, begin to put restrictions on – they don't like the federal government being able to put restrictions on what's going to appear in the mail, because they're afraid of giving additional power to the federal government. They know that the federal government might at some point be used to restrict slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But So what they do is they say, hey, you've got to send this stuff through the mail, but as soon as it arrives in Charleston or Tuscaloosa or wherever else, it's Richmond, wherever it ends up, the local postmaster can then destroy it. So he's sort of putting a lot of local control in place. And this is something, you know, they were trying to prosecute those who sent abolitionist literature down to the South. They tried to prosecute those people for inciting rebellion. And whenever they, you know, appealed to the New York governor to send these abolitionists down, the New York governor said, well, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
But if these people who'd sent the literature had ever been caught within the borders of a southern state, they would have been in a lot of trouble.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Both white and black abolitionists ventured into the South at their own peril. Okay, we don't know to what extent Nat Turner was influenced by this or whether he was responding to a call to rise or not, or this is just entirely spontaneous. But at any rate, he got and killed his family. He got his followers. And then what happened next?
So the rebellion begins to sort of, you know, snowball. They go from house to house. Largely on foot, but they, you know, at each house they're gathering more sort of weapons and horses and other things. It's really unclear how many people were involved in this. The estimates at the time, you know, is talk about 80 people. Those seem to be sort of exaggerated, and there were people sort of constantly joining and then drifting off. Particularly as it became clear the rebellion wasn't going to go anywhere. But so it begins that Sunday night, late in Sunday night, early Monday morning, and they have, you know, I don't know whether you'd call it some success, but they kill a lot of people through about midday on Monday, and then you know, sort of their one advantage, I think, is surprise, that they come upon people not expecting it, and as soon as word begins to spread, local militia groups begin assembling. The county seat is called Jerusalem. It's Cortland, called Cortland now. It is Jerusalem then, and it's across a small river. And that seemed to be where the rebellion was sort of headed. They were meandering towards that. Sort of the local militia gets assembled in Jerusalem and then crosses the river and comes over, and there's a small skirmish at a place called Parker's Field, and that sort of pushes the rebellion back, and that's the end of their, you know, I'd say, quote unquote, successes. Then after that, things sort of begin to really unravel. They start, the farms they're coming to are deserted. They can't find white people. Some of the slaves, the rebels that they have, drift off. It's really unclear how many of them were ever sort of a part of this voluntarily versus were sort of coerced.
I imagine there was some degree of coercion.
Seems to be, and in some of the trials afterwards, seems to be some of the defense that people have, that some of the younger sort of adolescent, the boys, didn't have a whole lot to do with it, and some of those people seem to be either outright acquitted or sentenced to transportation.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with law professor Al Brophy from the University of North Carolina, who's telling us all about Nat Turner's slave rebellion. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll continue our conversation with Al, so stick around.
Here I stand, a man not free, whip markers on my back, shackles on both feet, picking cotton in a stone heap, pray the Lord my soul keep, for one day he came and told me, in the year of 1831, I awoke at dawn to see his vision in the sun, it seemed that the clouds parted to reveal his tongue, he said, my son, the revolution has begun, and with that, I knew the message was clear, kill the oppressor who kept us in prison for years, raped our women and laughed in our tears, made us build their land while they sit back.
Well, Doug, I'm looking at the counter here in the studio. I'm looking over at Mark, and I'm not seeing any toys. I'm not seeing any props. I have no clue about what this quiz is going to be about.
Oh, it's going to be about a good one. It's going to be about the Constitution, and that's all that matters.
What a surprise. It's about the Constitution. I'm stunned. All right. We have no clue then prior to beginning, so I'm simply going to see, do we have a contestant?
Yes, sir.
We do have a contestant that sounds like a lady. Who are you, lady?
Yes. Taylor,
where are you from, Taylor?
I'm Lenore City, Tennessee.
Lenore City, Tennessee. I know Lenore City, Tennessee. It is a beautiful place right near the shores of Teleco Lake.
Yes.
Oh, it's a gorgeous place, rolling countryside. Okay, well, now I've got sort of a nice visual image here. I'm envisioning you sitting among the rolling pastures with the cows in the distance and the birds singing. Is that where you are?
Not at the moment, but that sounds beautiful.
That does sound beautiful. All right, Doug, give us a pastoral quiz.
Okay, so our quiz this morning is about the Ninth Amendment.
The Ninth Amendment.
Taylor, I'm going to read the question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
The Ninth Amendment states, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. What rights is this pertaining to?
Oh, man.
Is it A, amendments that the convention had rejected, B, the Bill of Rights, C, environmental rights, or D, kind of every other fundamental right that just isn't listed?
Okay, so the Ninth Amendment, in that language you quoted, what rights is it talking about? Do you need to hear it again, Taylor?
Yeah, let's go over it one more time.
Okay, one more time.
All right, so here's what the Ninth Amendment says. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. My question to you, Taylor, is what rights is this amendment pertaining to?
Which other rights? Those other rights that
exactly.
shall not be disparaged. So when we're talking about those things,
mm-hmm.
okay.
This is Ninth Amendment.
Okay, what are we talking about, Taylor? And what are the choices again?
Amendments that the convention rejected.
Okay.
The Bill of Rights. C, environmental rights. Or D, kind of every other fundamental right that just isn't listed.
Okay, so what are these other rights? You got four choices, Taylor.
Well, I don't think it's the ones that the Constitution got rid of.
Okay, not the rejected ones.
No, and probably not environmental.
Okay, yeah.
I would.
You have to forgive Doug here. He's one of these hippie tree hugging types. You have to forgive Doug.
I love trees.
He does love trees. We all love trees. All right, go on.
Is there something about breathing that I embrace?
Breathing. That's a very important thing. Okay, so you've eliminated A and C, I believe. What are your other choices?
Mm-hmm. Well, it would either be the Bill of Rights or all the other powers.
Okay.
And I'm thinking it would be the Bill of Rights.
Okay, now let's be clear that when we're talking about the rights that are being talked about in the Ninth Amendment, we're talking about those that have not been specified, right?
Yeah, this is really a question about enumeration.
Right.
As much as anything.
So it's saying the enumeration of certain rights doesn't deny or disparage other rights. And what we're looking for is what are those other rights? Okay. Does that affect your answer, Taylor?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
What are these other rights?
I guess it would just be the other rights not specifically enumerated.
And what answer choice is
in
that?
The Constitution. I think that's B. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Oh, right. Tremendous.
Well
we got
done.
That.
Okay.
Tremendous. Now, you might perceive me, Doug, as having helped out a little bit there, but that's because I wanted to be clear. I mean,
sure.
We're talking about two groups of rights. Number one, the enumerated rights.
That's right.
And number two, something else, other rights. And
non-enumerated.
Right. And that's what you were looking for.
I was.
And I think as soon as we clarified that for Taylor, she immediately jumped on. So congratulations, Taylor.
Oh, thank you.
Tremendous. You've just earned a YWC t-shirt, so send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org with your t-shirt size.
Okay.
We'll send you one via snail mail, and we will also send you a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. But before we go, let's talk a little bit more about this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is a great example of James Madison still getting his way.
Yes.
Because, when he submitted this, you remember at the convention, he had concerns about trying to enumerate rights.
Exactly.
And so he was, I wouldn't say against, I would say hesitant strategically hesitant.
Yeah.
And in the end, he supported a Bill of Rights, of course.
Like, then he ended up writing it. I mean, it's a fascinating tale. I mean, the first part of it, Madison said, we don't need no stinking Bill of Rights. And he had his reasons, okay? Mm-hmm. Too numerous to go into right here. But among them was, you know, if we set out a list of rights, we're going to read that as an exclusive list. Mm-hmm. And that will deny or disparage other things we might have forgotten.
Yeah. So what he does is when he's essentially working to draft the Bill of Rights, he slips in the Ninth Amendment.
The Ninth Amendment. That's...
Well, what becomes the Ninth Amendment.
Right.
And essentially it says, look, just because it's written down doesn't mean that you don't have that right.
Right. Now, then, of course, the next big question is, if we're going to talk about unenumerated rights, what are they? And here's the kicker. Who gets to decide what they are?
Well, you know who gets to decide.
Well,
what they
the Supreme
are.
Court does everything these days, at least since Marbury versus Madison. But that's still controversial. And bring it up seriously. I mean, unenumerated rights.
No, I was laughing because you said since Marbury versus Madison.
Yeah.
As though that was just, you know, a couple of years ago.
Well, you know, in my mind, it's alive every day. But here's the thing. I mean, you know, that even these days, things like privacy are very controversial. And people are apt to say, where does it say that in the Constitution? Well, it doesn't, except for the Ninth Amendment, which specifically leaves the door open for someone to say there are these other rights out there, too, and those other rights can be very controversial.
I'm amazed that there aren't more challenges on the basis of the Ninth Amendment.
It's actually a bit of a mystery. There are some competing doctrines that people use rather than the Ninth Amendment itself to establish these other fundamental rights. But now you got a whole semester's worth of discussion there. So we're going to have to draw this to a close. Thank you very much, Taylor, and congratulations on winning your quiz.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you, Doug.
You bet, Stuart. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue my conversation with UNC law professor Al Brophy, all about something called Nat Turner's Rebellion.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about, we've given sort of the broad outlines of this. It didn't last long. It petered out fairly quickly. The militia essentially put them down. But what was there an actual final pitch battle? What was the actual end point of this?
Yeah, absolutely. So things are unraveling Monday afternoon. Monday evening, they stay in the sort of around the slave quarters of the largest plantation in the county. There were about 80 enslaved people who lived and worked there. And it doesn't seem like they got much sleep that evening. And so the next morning, this is now Tuesday, a lot of people have drifted off. They go to make one final pitched battle at the home of Dr. Blunt, who is an elderly man. And Dr. Blunt and some of the people who worked for him, white people who worked for him, and also some enslaved people, put down that there was a battle at his house, and they put down that the rebellion there captured some people, and after that sort of everything just sort of people drifted away. Nat Turner they couldn't find. It took I guess about 2 months, month and a half. They caught him finally at the end of October 1831, but he was sort of hiding in the out in the community, and so by the afternoon, by Tuesday afternoon, the rebellion was over, and there were some real vicious reprisals by the militia units that had poured in now from Richmond, and some had come up from North Carolina and from other counties in
all the way from North Carolina.
Yeah,
so they
yeah.
were really sounding the alarm then.
They were. Murfreesboro, North Carolina, is one of the closest large towns, and they came over. Some Marines, I guess, came over from Norfolk, and in the immediate aftermath, a number of people were summarily executed by these local militia, and it's a little bit unclear how many. We're pretty sure that there were at least 10, and it might have been a little bit more than that. It's a little unclear. And then those who survived that initial sort of putting down of the rebellion were then tried.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get to the trials,
yeah.
which I understand were the focus of your law review article, and so that's very important too. This is obviously violent. Let's talk a little bit about the violence on both sides. Now, Nat Turner, did he murder the entire slave-owning family that who owned him? I mean, men, women, children, everybody?
Yes.
Okay, that's certainly unfortunate.
Very much so. The violence on all sides, you know, it's so tragic and so illustrative, I think, of the slaveholding system. And what to me is interesting is, so Turner's family, white family, is they die, and a number of other families who have very close connections to Turner and the other about half dozen rebels who started with him. Some of this takes on a real look of not just sort of random violence, but really sort of focused violence, where it's almost like there's some very, very dark and violent history here that we have a difficult time recovering.
That was going to be my next question. I'm not attempting to defend slavery. I'm not attempting to justify it. But, you know, obviously there are different sorts of slave owners and they act in different ways. Was there any evidence that Turner's family had been particularly brutal or cruel to him?
Some people – so he was owned by several different members of the Turner family at various points. Some had been nicer than others. As I recall, the family who owned him right as the rebellion was beginning was substantially nicer to him.
And they're the people who got killed. Yeah, I know. It's just a matter of relative cruelty.
Than others. But what interests me about this is that there seems to have been very close connections of the main rebels to the people who were primarily targeted. You know, so they or their spouses had been owned or were owned by the people who were killed. It's almost like a feud, and you know, I'm not sure historians have gotten. It's sort of hard to reconstruct these family relationships, but the people who've begun to do that, I think, that's one of the things that sticks out in my mind. That there's almost not a randomness to this. That it is.
Sounds like revenge killings. Yeah, targeted revenge killings. And do we know any again, I don't want to get too gory, but do we know any details? Were these particularly brutal murderings? Was there torture involved?
The descriptions that I've read come mostly from sort of, you know, the eyewitness accounts during the trials. And I'm not sure that there can be a pleasant way to murder somebody, but these sure seem gruesome.
Okay, so it was pretty gruesome, and men, women, children all being killed. So again, not to defend the institution of slavery, but you can understand why the people of the southern part of Virginia and North Carolina would be very concerned about this. And so how many people, how many slave-owning families were killed ultimately?
So the numbers of white people who died are around 58.
Wow, that is a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that it's a little bit unclear. There were maybe some children who may or may not be accounted for in that number, but it's around 58. And then a lot of enslaved people were also killed, some outright, and some, it seems surely they were involved in the rebellion, right, at the Parker's Field, and then some right in the aftermath, and then some others, you know, maybe look like they were just sort of caught up in the excitement and violence.
Yeah, well, that was actually going to be my next question. Now we've got, so it's roughly 58 white families and white people who get killed, and then how many people, how many slaves are killed, whether during the rebellion or during the reprisals afterward?
Yeah, it's really difficult to know. The estimates vary widely. A lot of the initial reports are sort of in the dozens or the tens, maybe 80. I'm somewhat skeptical of some of those. We know that 10 enslaved people were killed sort of during the rebellion, at least, because their owners petitioned the legislature to ask for compensation for them and say, hey, if they'd survived to be tried, they would have been executed and we would have gotten compensation, but they were executed, you know, they died in the rebellion, we should get compensation. The legislature ends up not giving any of them compensation. But so we can set a lower bound at 10, and it looks like there were some others who also died. We can tell from sort of newspaper accounts.
And I'm imagining some of those reprisals were pretty cruel as well.
Gruesome.
Gruesome accounts of slaves being murdered at the end of all of this.
At the end, yeah. I mean, you know, there's one person who's, I think, from North Carolina. He's in the militia, and he's writing to his sister talking about what was done to torturing slaves to get them to confess, you know, also branding, all sorts of things. Dragging him, one person behind a horse. He ends up dying. I mean, this is really and he says something like, you know, this barbarism, these people were guilty, but the barbarism shouldn't have been perpetrated. I mean, it's violence on all sides, and it really, to me, drives home the sort of brutality that everybody was involved in.
Yeah, and that's, I think, it's important that we talk about these things, because on the one hand, from a modern perspective, you think, 50, 100 people, it's not a big deal. It's unfortunate, but it's not a big deal. But we have to remember that there were a lot fewer people in the United States then than there are now. And so those numbers were proportionately much larger than they would be today. And secondly, and the reason I keep asking you about the brutality on both sides of this, that's what makes the impression. That's what makes the impression both ways.
Absolutely. And it seems to me, particularly, you know, in the wake of the rebellion and after the rebellion's been put down, this sort of the vigilante response, right? Rather than having, hey, the attitude, hey, let's have a trial, figure out what happens. I mean, and I just, you can understand the anger and frustration, but
that does bring us, though, to the trials. You've mentioned the trials several times. I was actually surprised that there were trials. I figured there would be brutal reprisals. I figured there'd be vigilante action. I figured there might be some individual action by individual slave owners once they'd recovered their rebellious slaves, assuming they were still alive.
Sure.
But I didn't anticipate before, of course, I read your article, that there would be actual trials involving slaves. So please tell me why that happened, how that happened.
Yeah, I mean, Stuart, you put your finger on a really important point, that one would think that the response would have been by the slave owners themselves or the militia.
Yeah. I mean, these are not considered human beings, so they've got no constitutional rights. There's no due process you have to give them. You just shoot them down or beat them or torture them or whatever you're going to do to them, which was common practice. So, again, please, go on.
Sure. And so, and that, in fact, was, you know, the typical response, so that, you know, and there are all sorts of judicial opinions. There's this famous one called State v. Mann out of North Carolina that basically says owners should have uncontrolled authority over the body of their slaves. There was, at some point, courts began to say, hey, you know, you can't kill an enslaved person. That has to be done through judicial means. But almost anything else was fair game. But I think the trials themselves arise from a series of pressures, right? So there was some sense that the community needed to figure out what had actually gone on, and get some answers. And this needed to be, you needed to figure out who was guilty and who wasn't. Part of the process of rooting out the rebellion and stopping another one was figuring out what had happened. And then,
so it was an investigatory thing. Let's put them on trial, and then we can bring everybody in and have testimony and figure this out.
Figure it out, have an accounting. To the extent that there were white people who hadn't adequately controlled their slaves, that was something that could be addressed going forward, right? Because one of the major results of the rebellion was to demand that white slave owners be harsher and have better control over the enslaved population. But and part of this also is you need to figure out who's not guilty, and then return those people to their owners, the people who were guilty and were either sentenced to be transported, sold outside of the state, or in most cases executed. Their owners then received compensation.
So this was basically a property case when it came to actual liabilities then.
Yeah, so part of this is you need to figure out who's going to get compensation from the state. So there's all these sorts of, you know, factors that push into these trials, and they're quite brief. I mean, there'll be several of them a day, in September. So you just go one day after another, and you'll have, you know, three, maybe four trials in a day. So, I mean, these are brief. It's not the sort of, you know, extensive due process that we're familiar with. But there was a procedure by which the government sort of figured out who was guilty, which owners would receive compensation, which people tried to sort out who was guilty and who wasn't guilty.
And to emphasize it once more, this was all for the benefit of the slave owners, not the slaves.
An individual slave
might very well wish to be exonerated because then he's not going to be punished specifically, perhaps. But on the other hand, I mean, they're primarily concerned about property rights in the slave owners and protecting slave owners going forward.
Yeah, and protecting the slave system going forward.
Right.
I mean, I think this is – we think about trials as part of justice, and I think in this era we should think of the trial more as a technology that was, you know, working in conjunction with the slave system to make the slave system function better.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Al Brophy of the University of North Carolina, all about something called Nat Turner's Rebellion, the most significant slave rebellion in the history of the United States. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish our discussion with Al Brophy. Stay tuned.
I'm the one that they don't teach you in class about. I'm the one who ran up in the master's house, put a knife to his neck and ain't gagged his mouth, charged him for black murder. I'm Nat Turner. I'm the one that they don't teach you in class about. I'm the one who ran up in the master's house, put a knife to his neck and ain't gagged his mouth, charged him for black murder. I'm Nat Turner. Through the darkness, we march like hellions. They call it a massacre, I call it a rebellion. We move quickly with no time to spare. Bloodlust leave no light.
On March 4th, 1809, the nation wept as it said farewell to President Thomas Jefferson and settled for a far inferior replacement, James Madison, a glorified bookworm whose greatest presidential accomplishments include losing a war to Canada and overseeing a fire-based remodeling of the White House. American schoolchildren everywhere can proudly recite the first three presidents, lingering on Jefferson's sweet name, before getting tripped up. Was it Monroe next or Madison? The era of good feelings was primarily feeling nostalgic for Jefferson. Madison was so afraid of executive authority that when he was president, he needed congressional approval for bathroom breaks. When Jefferson was president, he fought pirates and stole Madison's lunch money to pay for the Louisiana Purchase. Father of the Constitution? So Madison got up a sweat for 30 seconds and claims that he's responsible for American government? Please, let's remember the true hero, Thomas Jefferson.
Ben, what the heck was that?
It was the Madison Minute.
Madison Minute, my foot. That was all about Thomas Jefferson.
There was a lot of stuff about Madison in there.
There wasn't anything good about Madison in there. You're making all these... What's going on?
Well, you didn't tell me it had to be all positive.
I shouldn't have told you you could even do this thing. I don't even remember why I let you on the radio show.
Nepotism, surely.
Well, thank you very much for that Jefferson Minute. We'll have to correct that in subsequent episodes.
Madison was only allowed to become president because Jefferson removed the "you must be this tall to be president" sign outside the White House.
All right, that's the last time I ask a UVA student to help me with a Madison Minute. All right, that's enough nonsense from Ben. Now it's time to continue our discussion with Al Brophy about Nat Turner's rebellion and about the strange fact that there were actually trials of some of the African-American slaves after the rebellion was over.
Tell me about some of these trials. What were some of the more notable ones that were held, or what came in there?
So there's a couple of things that interest me about this, right? The defense lawyers I am particularly interested in. So, you know, I think this in some of the defense lawyers I think are sort of early versions of public interest lawyers. There's one man in particular, James French, who I think was a William and Mary graduate, and he was maybe about age 30 also, and he represented more slaves than anybody else, and he seems to have been very sort of aggressive in trying to mount defenses. He was sort of involved in the writing letters to the Richmond newspaper to try and shape how people thought about the rebellion, tried to argue that there hadn't been a lot of pre-planning, tried to indict that young slave girl I'd mentioned earlier who said, hey, there was a planning at a church meeting months earlier. And then after that, after the trials are over, French leaves the practice of law, goes out west, writes a novel that depicts Native Americans in a favorable light, argues they've been treated unfairly, comes back later to Richmond and is involved in mesmerism. He's a very interesting guy. I wish we could find out more about him. But, I mean, he seems to have been genuinely trying to use the system to effect some kind of justice for slaves. Hmm. Some of the rest we don't know so much about. There's this guy, Thomas Gray, who writes the Confessions of Nat Turner and publishes them right about the time Nat Turner's executed. So he's sort of making money off. He represents some of the slaves. He makes money off of this. But he seems to portray Turner in at least some sympathetic light. And one of the great mysteries of all this, right, is these Confessions of Nat Turner. How much of this is actually Nat Turner speaking versus sort of Thomas Gray putting words into his mouth? And if you read the Confessions of Nat Turner, some of it sounds an awful lot like the stilted formal language of a 19th century lawyer. And some of it sounds a little bit more like, wow, this actually could be really pretty much Turner speaking. So there's some great sort of stories, and again, the sort of the mystery of this invites a lot of speculation. I think that's what makes this such a great.
And I want to hear more about those confessions in a moment. But again, you've said something that surprises me. They had lawyers. The slaves had lawyers that were appointed to represent them.
They did, and the lawyers were paid by the slave owners.
That's extraordinary.
It is. It is. But again, I think this is, you know, there needed to, the system to function well had to be able to figure out who's guilty and who isn't. And a lot of the slave owners probably, even if their slaves were partly guilty, wouldn't want them executed or sold somewhere else. This would be, you know, might be a loss of property to them. It would be disruptive to their the family members of the enslaved people. I mean, there's all sorts of, I think, countervailing imperatives, you know. So the zealous pro-slavery people wanted vigorous prosecution. Some in the white community were saying, "Hey, this is going too far. There are a lot of people being swept up in this." I think some slave owners who probably were not terribly happy that their slaves were being prosecuted. I mean, you look at it from a distance and it looks like a very neat picture, and then you get up close, you know, it's like an impressionist picture, right? At a distance it makes sense, and then you get up closer and you're like, wow, there are an awful lot of dots there, not all of them in the place I would have expected them.
Well, what did they find out about Nat Turner, or at least what did he say in his confessions or his alleged confessions?
So, going back to sort of the idea of planning, he says he, you know, came up with this on his own, and to the extent that other people were involved in also planning rebellions, they were just people who had similar ideas to him. And, you know, he's trying, I think, putting fear into the hearts of other slave owners by saying, don't you think other people could think the same thing I did?
Did he put the finger on anybody else? I mean, did he rat out any of his co-conspirators, or did he more or less say this was my idea?
He spoke now Turner was one of the very last people to be tried, because they didn't capture him until October, and the trials for most everybody had been in September, and the key people had either been killed during the rebellion or executed afterwards. Mm-hmm. So there weren't a whole lot of people for Turner at this point to implicate. And you know, he talks a little bit about that meeting at that Mill Pond Sunday when the whole thing got started, and talks, as I recall, some about his co-conspirators. But he was believed to be, and was taking credit, if that's the appropriate word, as sort of as the leader of this. I think that's sort of how everybody approached this. Then after the next spring, there were a few trials of free black people for involvement. I think one of them was found guilty and executed, and the others were acquitted. So there's, you know, that's another one of the sort of stories that emerges from this, how there may have been some cooperation or support from the free community to the enslaved. And also, there's a small Native American population. And again, there's this oral history, right, that, that the Native Americans worked in conjunction with the rebels and helped maybe harbor some of the fugitives also.
Now, I'm guessing this became a great cause célèbre because of all of this newspaper coverage and all these lawyers coming in to represent these people. Could you talk a little bit about the effect of the Nat Turner Rebellion?
Sure. It struck fear in people, in white people. It captured the attention of the nation, and the repercussions vibrated outwards. So, in lots of different counties, miles and miles away from Southampton, there were trials of other supposed rebels. Down in Sampson and Duplin County, North Carolina, which is, 100 miles, maybe more away, there are trials of suspected rebels that seem to have been set in motion by the fear of the Turner Rebellion. So as far as looking back on it, it looks like there was no rebellion afoot there, but, you know, and then up in the Shenandoah Valley, up in Rockbridge County, there was a lot of fear that, that some of the enslaved people, some who were owned by Washington College, actually, now Washington and Lee University, might be planning rebellion. Up in Spotsylvania by Fredericksburg, again, dozens of miles away, it was 80 miles away maybe, there's some trials of a few people. I mean, there's all over, there's this fear that, that slaves are planning rebellion. Not a lot of evidence that that was actually happening. And then what happened was in the fall of 1831, some Quakers petitioned the Virginia legislature to say, hey, this violence is a danger to white people, is all born of the slave system, and we need to end slavery in Virginia. And that set off a very rich debate in January through March of 1832 in the Virginia legislature about what, if anything, should be done about slavery. And yet a number of people, you'll recall that in this era, what is now West Virginia was part of Virginia. So in right. Western Virginia, where there were very, very few enslaved people, a lot of the, and then in the Shenandoah Valley also, a lot of the representatives wanted to end slavery. They thought it was bad economically. They didn't like the violence. They were anti-slavery, or right. at least not zealously pro-slavery.
There also this prompted not merely a crackdown, which is the expected result, but it prompted a wider debate.
It's a really interesting. It's one of the episodes in American history where violence led not just to tightening further restrictions, but also to reflection of whether this, in fact, was the right thing to do. And that, the people in Western Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's grandson, who was a representative from Albemarle County at that point, spoke against slavery. And their idea was a gradual abolition plan where, people born, after 1845 would be free, and they'd be gradually emancipating people after that also. Might have ended slavery in Virginia around 1920 if the plan had been adopted. It's interesting to think
very
about
gradual,
this.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very gradual. All of those plans ultimately were defeated, though some of the votes were actually pretty close.
I wonder if we could consider it sort of the genesis of the West Virginia secessionist movement. Because they're already getting concerned here 20 years before the Civil War that they really don't want slavery. In fact, the part of Virginia where I live in Southwest Virginia was also very pro-Union, and was the story goes that the only reason that we didn't become part of West Virginia over here was because the delegate who was supposed to go to the secessionist legislature got drunk and fell off his mule.
Oh, God.
And I don't know if that's merely apocryphal, but the point is that a lot of areas of Virginia that were less suited to plantation labor were much less inclined toward slavery. And this rebellion seems to have prompted a bit more anti-slavery sentiment as well as pro-slavery reaction.
It's one of the often forgotten pieces of Virginia history, and Southern history more generally, that people were anti. There was more anti-slavery sentiment than you might have expected. One of the tragedies, though, of this is the anti-slavery movement fails in 1832, and then a young professor of history at William and Mary named Thomas Dew writes a review of these debates, and he goes through like why abolition wouldn't make sense. The slaves' labor was too valuable. The people didn't want free people living in Virginia, so they say, well, you'd have to move them out of the state, and that would be too expensive. And he goes through a whole sort of set of pro-slavery arguments, concluding with slavery is great for white people, and it, you know, civilizes the enslaved also. I mean, it's a vicious tract, and I highly recommend it if you're interested in these kinds of arguments. It in 100 pages, it covers every pro-slavery argument you could think he could think of.
Wow.
So that is often seen as the turning point, right? After Thomas Dew's review of the debates, there's much less anti-slavery sentiment, and after about 1832 to 35, anti-slavery sentiment is very difficult to express.
Oh, Al, this is like the academic's nightmare. This guy wrote apparently a very effective academic article, but on the wrong side. And he convinced people. I mean, every professor wants to write that wonderful article that then changes the world. He did. This fellow Dew changed the world, at least in Virginia, and helped to stamp out anti-slavery sentiment.
Well, I think that's one of the important stories about this, is how much pro-slavery academics were involved in the debate, and how much they pushed that in the years leading into Civil War. Dew is critical. There's this guy Thomas Cobb, who's a law professor at the University of Georgia, who writes a pro-slavery treatise in the 1850s, and he then he's a central person in getting Georgia to secede from the Union, and then he's a general in the Confederate Army, and he dies at Fredericksburg. I mean, it's an interesting story, the number of academics who are sort of central to the pro-slavery debate and how much they contribute to it.
You know, that is remarkable, but there are other analogs to this. I'm reminded of how the lawyers and some of the academics in Germany supported the Nazi movement.
Yeah.
And of course, there was a purge of all the Jews and all the anti-Nazi elements, but I think there were also a number of academics in Germany who supported that horrible ideology, and so I guess it's really not surprising that it also existed in our country. But we're running out of time, Al, here, so what's your grand summation? What should people remember about Nat Turner's Rebellion?
It was the largest slave rebellion of its era, and it was a turning point on the road to civil war. Before it, there were a lot of people in the South who were anti-slavery. After it, those people either changed their views or were afraid to express them. And though Nat Turner couldn't have envisioned it in 1831, in 30 years later, the Civil War begins. 34 years after his rebellion, the institution of slavery is over.
Well, Al Brophy of Law School at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, thanks so very, very much for telling us about this tragic but fascinating episode in our constitutional history.
Stuart, I enjoyed it and looking forward to chatting with you again sometime.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to law professor Al Brophy of the University of North Carolina for telling us all about Nat Turner's Rebellion in that interview via Skype. That was just great. Thanks also to young Benjamin Harris. Or I'm not even sure I should thank Benjamin Harris for that ridiculous Madison minute that he, Jefferson, you know, okay, fine. Thanks, Ben, anyway, for showing up. I'm not even sure we're going to run his segment. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment.